Well, hello everyone. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter. Welcome again to the Empowering Neurologist. You know, in football, it's been said that the best defense is a good offense. And in COVID-19, what do we say? Well, we don't yet have an offense. The offense hasn't yet taken the field, so we have to really rely upon defense. We don't yet have anything offensive to use, any weapons to combat the virus. So we really have to focus on our defense, meaning our immune systems. One of the important observations in COVID-19 infection is that outcome seems to be very much related to age. Older individuals have a much higher risk for having a more complicated, if not worse, outcome. And one of the things we know happens as we age is our immune systems become senescent, meaning old, less functional, less able to reproduce. And this immunosenescence is correlated with bad outcome as it relates to this virus. Further, we know that immunosenescence seems to be correlated with other chronic illnesses like diabetes, obesity, coronary artery disease, chronic pulmonary disease. So there seems to be a relationship here then between the functionality of our immune systems, how we handle issues when we are confronted by them, and how we're able to keep inflammation in check. A commonality between chronic conditions, as I mentioned, and our response negatively or effectively to COVID-19 infection. That said, I thought it would be very instructive for us today to spend time with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Dr. Bland is certainly one of the most respected individuals on the planet in the area of functional medicine. As a matter of fact, he coined the term himself, and is a founder of the Institute for Functional Medicine. He now serves as the CEO of the Personalized Lifestyle and Medicine Institute, and he is somebody that I have admired and been happy to have mentor me over the years in terms of functional medicine, an amazing resource of information. Dr. Bland will spend time with us today talking about the whole notion of immunosenescence, and the idea of what we can do to get rid of senescent cells, something called senolytic therapy, and the whole broader category of what is called senotherapeutics. So without further complication or discussion from me, let's jump right into our interview. Well, hello, Dr. Bland. It sure is great to spend some time with you today.
Well, Dr. Perlmutter, there are very few people in the world that I would prefer to be spending this moment with other than you. So thank you. This really
well, we're not exciting. Locked down together, but may as well be. That said, in the midst of this whole situation with COVID-19, as I said in the intro, as it's been said in football, the best defense is a good offense. We don't really have an offense. We have to defer to our defense, which is our immune system. And let's just begin our time together talking about what happens as our immune with our age, as we age, what happens to our immune systems, and how might that be playing a role in terms of the poorer outcome that we see in people who are getting on in years.
Yes, you know, it's amazing to me that coincidence in life or serendipity comes up so many times in the way that we experience our life. And for me, I started down this journey of trying to understand immune aging about 5 years ago, really seriously 3 years ago, well before COVID-19, because I really started to feel that a lot of the problems that we have, chronic health problems, are tied to senescence or aging of our immune system, which is partly tied to our birthdays, but more tied to the experience that our immune system undergoes over the course of living, the things that we do to it. And the immune system can be worn out. There's no question about it. You know, that the cells that make up our immune system, this infantry and very complex network that we call the immunological system, those cells that are our defensive bulwark against all sorts of things that are in the inside and outside world can get fatigued and ultimately run out of gas and can lose their ability to protect us. And I was really reminded of that from my experience in the early 80s when I was at the Pauling Institute in Palo Alto, California, and the AIDS epidemic was just really in its early days. And these young men were coming in who had bankrupt immune systems, and they had all sorts of infectious diseases. They had fungal infections, they had bacterial infections, they had viral infections. I mean, they were being treated with multiple antifungals, antibacterials, antibiotics, because their immune system had been so compromised that they were unable to mount a defense against the organisms that we're all experiencing 24/7. And I think that people don't understand that in the absence of a vigilant immune system, the outside world is a pretty hostile place. It can take us over. And the degree to which a person is sensitive to, or let's call it at risk to, viruses or bacteria or funguses is going to be dependent upon the integrity of their immune system. And I think in the past, people have thought, well, that's just the luck of the draw. I was either born with a good immune system or born with a bad one. And now we're learning that's not the case, that the immune system is really very, very responsive to how we treat it. If we treat it with respect, if we give it the right things that it can do its job, it can rejuvenate itself. And in fact, as I pointed out in basic kind of immune system physiology, that every 10 seconds, our body makes 1 million white blood cells, 10 million platelet cells, or excuse me, 10 million red blood cells, in 30 million platelet cells. So it's constantly rejuvenating our immune system. But if it is in a damaged state because we haven't given it the right tools it needs to maintain its vigilance, then those cells that come out are going to be weak. They're going to be not capable of defending and being as vigilant against hostility, internal and external, including even those things that live in our gut, our microbiome, with some of which are friendly and some of which are not. So our immune system has to constantly be on guard against our own internal bacterial species as well. And if you don't have a vigilant immune system because you haven't treated it right, you haven't treated it with respect, then suddenly you are much more susceptible to all sorts of conditions that would take you over.
Well, it's clear, as you described then, that our immune systems with chronological time become, that's a bit redundant, as opposed to biological aging, become less functional, less able to do their job and defend us and recognize friend versus foe. But it seems also clear then, especially through the lens of who's having a bad outcome with respect to COVID-19, that there are some things along the way that people can do, lifestyle choices, that can hasten this decline in immune function.
Yes, and I think that one of the things that we have learned only recently in the studies of the immune system, and this won a discoverer in Japan the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology just 4 years ago, was the process of how the immune system cleanses itself, and it's a process called autophagy. And although that's a very, very sophisticated term with a lot of deep science below it, what it really means is that if you give the body the right raw materials and the right support, it has a way of taking the damaged, what are called zombie cells. Isn't that a great name? Zombie cells?
Night of the Living Dead.
Yet to be informed immune cells that will be able to do a much better job in defending us. And that begs the question then, gee whiz, this sounds like magic. You know, how would I do that? How would I get rid of zombie cells so that I can revitalize my immune system? We call it immunorejuvenation. And the answer is things that we're so aware of that you have been speaking about for years, how we eat, how we think, how we breathe, how we move, how we sleep, how we manage stress, the exposure to toxins. Every one of those things is a factor that influences this process of immune system renewal. And if we can understand this is the magic Rosetta Stone to defend ourselves against foreign invaders, which are present all the time. I mean, COVID-19 has certainly not the last pandemic that we're going to be exposed to as a human species. We need to fortify then our ability to perform these processes of rejuvenating our immune system.
So I want to get back to the comparison to HIV/AIDS that you talked about in the early 1980s. I recall there were some similar sorts of experiences that I had working in an emergency room in a major metropolitan city hospital, Jackson Memorial in Miami. We really didn't have an understanding as to what was going on, the degree to which this could be transmissible, and what were those transmission vectors. But you brought up something that I think is really interesting, and that is this notion of, because the immune system is compromised by, in this case, the virus, then these individuals were a setup for other infections. We call them opportunistic infections, things like pneumocystis carinii, et cetera, and toxoplasmosis, et cetera. And in a sense, though, what we're seeing happening here is that this COVID infection is, in a sense, being opportunistic when the immune system is letting it do its damage based upon this dysfunctional immune system that you've just described.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point of differentiation. And we know that the HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, had a specific propensity to infect specific members of our immune system, those cells that were really involved with giving us defense, the so-called T helper cells. And so it was very insidious in that it actually caused the death of these cells preferentially, which really tipped the balance of our immune system so quickly into the negative. Now, it turns out that COVID-19 has also been found to have an effect on the immune system, but not nearly as virulent, not nearly as pathological as HIV. And so it's putting pressure on our immune system. So if the immune system is already in a depleted state, in other words, it has low reserve, it's already kind of worn itself slightly out because it has been treated well prior to the exposure to that virus. Now suddenly COVID-19 has a environment that's much more receptive to its infection. And it can both find a home in our body more quickly, and it can also be more mischievous in the way that it adversely affects our immune system. So it's like a dog chasing its tail. Once the immune system is depleted, the virus is more liable to take over. And once it takes over, it then has a more deleterious effect on the immune system. So now we get into what we see as the cytokine storm. These individuals that have a COVID-19 infection then unfortunately just goes south so fast. They come into the emergency room after trying to wait out at home. They don't feel well. They get admitted. And within a matter of hours, they go south and die. And how does that happen? It happens because their immune system gets so activated and so on guard and so alerted to this infection, and they have such little reserves to manage it, that the immune system just unbridles itself and unleashes all of its power, and a person actually dies as a consequence of its own immune hyperreaction by hyperinflammation, by mucus secretion, and all the kind of things the body does to try to defend itself, but it does so way overwhelmed without any control. So we now get in a runaway train situation because the whole immune system didn't have the ability to accommodate. It had no resilience. Its headspace was very limited. And now it just threw itself into total catastrophe.
Takes us to an interesting place, and that is this the balance that we look for, whereby in some instances inflammation is really a positive response, but it's this unbridled inflammation that characterizes the so-called cytokine storm. I'm not sure if when that term was originated. It might have been with Ebola when we started to hear about it, and with efforts then using anti-inflammatories to try to quench that on the front end. But it really calls to mind this notion that that inflammation is neither good nor bad. It's a system in our bodies that generally works for our benefit. But in this case, suddenly the stops are taken out and off it goes and basically lights us on fire based on what the word means, inflame. And that said, how might our bodies naturally then keep that fire from raging should we get infected?
Yeah, I think that that is a really important question. So let's just review quickly how the immune system works when it's exposed to a virus. So there are two components of the immune system, two kind of gross arms of the immune system. One is called the innate immune system, which is an ancient part of our immune system that's there to do search and destroy activity. This is occupied by certain kinds of white blood cells, so like the macrophage cells that actually put their big arms around foreign invaders like viruses, and they chemically kill them there by chemical warfare. And so they're our first line of defense. That is supposedly there, this innate immune system, to give immediate response to things that we're not used to seeing. Then the second tier of defense, which takes a little bit longer to grow in, is the so-called adaptive immune system. And the adaptive immune system are a different set of blood cells, white blood cells, and they have the responsibility for recognizing this foreigner and producing a memory effect of resistance to it that are called antibodies. And these antibodies are what gives rise to immunization and immunity. But it takes a while for the second tier set to get mobilized and do its work. So in the case of a viral infection, you really depend in the immediacy on your macrophage system, your innate cell-mediated immunity system. And that is an inflammation modulating system. It does its work by producing inflammatory mediators that actually hopefully recognize and destroy the foreigner. And if that doesn't work well, then it has to pass over and wait for the second tier system to kick in, the adaptive immune system. And that doesn't really work so much by inflammation. In fact, inflammation actually can attenuate the activity of the second cell, second system. So you don't want too much inflammation that by the time you get to the second tier. But if you have a system that is dysfunctional at the first level, you've depleted your immune system, so your cell-mediated immune system is not working up to snuff, then what happens, you get heightened inflammation, and that adversely affects then your second tier system, which then sets an imbalance in your immune system. And these are the people that don't respond to immunization very well. They don't have memory effects. They are more susceptible to second time infections to the same origin, same vector. And those are also the people then for whom inflammation that didn't get quenched and didn't get properly regulated in the first stage then can become a hyper-stimulated immune system in the second stage, because the body's doing everything it can to call out the guard. And so, as you said, inflammation goes from being good in the beginning to now becoming deleterious in the back, and in the extreme case can actually even be the cause of death in an extreme infection. So it's balance that's really the key to this whole point.
Then let's see if we can explore why it is that individuals who have this so-called chronic sterile inflammation, or an inflammatory response not to an infectious agent that is characteristic of the chronic degenerative conditions, coronary artery disease, diabetes, et cetera, why would they then be at risk for this dysregulation of their immune function to the extent that they develop the cytokine storm?
Oh, boy. Thank you.
Am I leading you okay here?
Oh, this is like we've been rehearsing this. It's fantastic.
Not the first time either.
No, that's exactly right. Thank goodness of this relationship we've shared over the decades. One thing you didn't mention on that list, which I want to add because I think it's another part of the story, is obesity. Because in the study that was just done in New York City, in which they followed, I think it was over 2,400 COVID-19 patients, and tried to address what were the comorbid factors that led to them getting infected and having a poor prognosis. When they published that data, which was just a few days ago, it was quite startling to, I think, many of us, in that the second, other than age was the number one comorbid risk factor, but the second one was obesity. It was more a common theme than was type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension. And so it begs the question, what do these all share in common? That was the point you were making. Well, In the case of obesity, what happens is the body fat, the adipose mass, is infiltrated with immune cells, and it becomes what's called angry fat. Angry fat is fat on fire, and it's a form of sterile inflammation, as you said. It doesn't have to be precipitated by an infection. It happens because of deranged metabolism, because the individual is eating too much of too little. They're overwhelming the body's compensation, the ability for fat to absorb those extra calories and that poor quality nutrition in a way that neutralizes its adverse effect on the body. And finally, what happens to the fat cells, the body fat gets fed up. That's my metaphor. It gets fed up. And it says, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm going to push back. And I'm going to tell the body, the rest of the body, that I'm pretty upset. And how does it do that? By the infiltration of these macrophages, these same blood white cells that I was mentioning in the innate immune system, that it communicates with in the fat mass, and it says to the macrophages, guys, I want you to tell the rest of the body that I'm really aggravated by the way I'm being treated. So they get out and they set this inflammatory message that is systemic. It's throughout the whole body now. It's not just in the fat. It travels through the blood. It goes to the brain, to the microglia. It goes to the liver, which is called the Kupffer cells. It goes to the circulating monocytes and macrophages. So now it becomes distributed throughout the whole body, which now influences what? The effect on the blood, on the arteries. It affects the heart. It affects the liver. It affects, well, every organ, basically. And now you're in a, as you said, in a state of resident chronic inflammation, which some people have called inflammaging, because it's associated with an adverse outcome of your numbers of birthdays in terms of your health. Inflammaging, it accelerates biological aging. And that's the incubator then in which a viral infection like COVID-19 can enter the system. It's already in a state of dysfunction and disturbance. And now it completely changes the ability of the body's normal response to the virus to become this inflamed response and dysregulated response.
I just reviewed a report out of China, a small study, and it was looking at laboratory analysis that might be predictive in terms of who would have a good versus bad outcome. And interestingly, we would think that things like C-reactive protein might be indicative. Certainly, interleukin 6 is indicative at about the time when the event, the cytokine storm, is beginning to occur. But more longer-term ability to predict was ALT. And what is ALT? It is a marker that is used to help determine who may be suffering from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And, I think I just got chills thinking about that, because it so plays into everything you're talking about. At University of Colorado, Dr. Richard Johnson has published some information, in fact, a decade ago now, talking about how the entrance point for all five of the markers for metabolic syndrome seem to involve fructose metabolism, increased urate production, and ultimately through the production of NAFDL to some degree, lead to this inflammatory response or dysregulation of inflammation that so characterizes these chronic diseases. So it's really incredible that all of the issues that we've been talking about for the past couple of decades are really front and center at this time. That, you know, the lifestyle choices that led to this immune dysregulation that we characterize or use nomenclature of things like obesity and type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, are all now really quite valid in terms of predictors of a dysregulated immune system and, as it relates to our current experience, bad outcome.
Yes, I think you said so much of importance. That was a lot of news to use, I think, for our viewer listeners. The liver, just to go back to this concept of fatty liver disorders, which we know is increasing in its prevalence in our culture, the liver is not only a metabolic organ, it is an immune organ. And I think a lot of people forget that about 10% of the mass of the cells that make up the liver our immune cells. They are these very macrophages that I was referring to that are the first guard against infection that are resident in the liver that are called Kupffer cells, K-U-P-F-F-E-R cells. And those cells are derived from the same stem cells that the macrophages that float around in our blood, and also those that are embedded in our brain that we call the microglia, and also that are resident in our intestinal tract in the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, which is where about 70% of the immune system is located, which is in our gut. So all of these are cross-communicating. The gut immune system cross-communicating with the liver immune system, cross-communicating with the blood immune system, cross-communicating with the brain immune system. And if you start to look then at the symptoms that we see with COVID-19, what organs does it have an influence on? It turns out it's the very organ where these immune cells are isolated or located. So you want to be treating all of these places with respect, the right gut, the right liver, the right blood, and the right brain, right? By providing the right tools to keep the immune system functioning in balance in all those places.
I want to amplify something you just brought to our attention, and that is the brain. And I think we're just beginning to get our arms around the fact that a powerful manifestation can be of this infection can be neurological. And in fact, one study published in the New England Journal of Medicine on the 15th of April just came out. It was a small study, I think 40 cases that were reviewed. More than half had confusion at the time they presented to the hospital. And at the time of discharge, one third had what was called dysexecutive function. In other words, the loss of ability to carry out purposeful action, especially on command, as well as things like lethargy and confusion. Now, these people were just discharged from the hospital, and the letter in New England Journal came out very quickly. What we don't know is how long will that will those symptoms continue. What we do know about the brain is that we oftentimes see evidence of creation of what are called feed-forward cycles. We've seen this in the chronic traumatic encephalopathy of football players, where once the process begins, it continues to smolder and clinically cause worsening of people over long term. The fact that one third of the people discharged from the hospital had residual neurologic compromise is a compelling bit of a metric, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I think that what you're so beautifully describing is that when we talk about an infection that influences immune system function in the way COVID-19 does, it's going to have what are called pleiotropic effects. It's going to have multiple effects on individuals. It's not just singly on the lungs. Now, I didn't mention that the lungs are another tissue that has resident macrophages. I should have said that, because we think of COVID-19 as a respiratory virus, but it's really an immune modulating virus that affects all these areas that have access to the virus that's where the immune system is present. So the symptoms that we're seeing and the degrees of pathology play out in different ways in different people based upon the most sensitive parts of their immune system. But certainly the lungs we know as a first point of attack for this this respiratory virus, and the lungs are a site of high immune cell density.
Well, it brings to my mind an interesting idea, and that is, first let me say that I had notes of things we would talk about today. I haven't referred to them yet. So this may go on for a while.
What else is new between us?
This started in Seattle, as you recall. One of the explanations for at least the cardiac involvement was the recent discovery of the abundance of these ACE2 receptors in the pericytes that line the coronary artery at the capillary level. Therefore, the idea was that the virus can bind to these ACE2 receptors and then influence the functionality of the coronary capillaries, hence the very common experience of elevated troponin levels, cardiac enzyme levels, and EKG changes seen in the very sick patients admitted to the intensive care units with COVID-19. But what you just said was, I think, very interesting, and that is that it is a systemic inflammatory event that therefore would explain why we're seeing such a systemic representation of this infection.
Yes, and I think to play off your point, the angiotensin, renin angiotensin system, the RAS system that is tied to what you were just describing with the angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptors on the surface of various tissues like cardiac tissue, is in part a system that regulates the response to stress, as we know. And it regulates vascular tone, it regulates all sorts of things that are related to immunological response to stress. So this particular interface between the ACE2 receptor and the virus spike protein and stress and underlying inflammation paints a picture of why certain people are much more at risk of the serious infectivity and symptoms because, as going back to our previous statements, if they're already in a depleted state of immunological vigilance and they have a disturbed immune system and they already are under physiological stress, it sets the tone for a hyper response to the virus. And it is interesting now, if we can segue slightly from that, to recognize that this was a very interesting paper, again, in the New England Journal of Medicine just within the last couple of weeks, looking at the ACE2 receptor and drugs that modify ACE. These are the angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors or the receptor blockers, the sartan family of drugs. And it was found that, or it was suggested that people on these drugs should be very cautious because maybe that would increase the activation of the virus by modifying the receptivity of these targets. It appears now, as more work is accumulating, that these drugs may have a positive effect, actually, on blunting the response to the virus. But the more important thing, I think, as a takeaway, other than the drugs, is that if you eat a complex diet that contains a lot of phytochemicals, that those phytochemicals, many of them, particularly in the flavonoid family and the polyol family of phytochemicals, have been found to modulate the receptivity of these ACE2 receptors. And so there are ways of modulating the RAS system and its responsiveness to viral infections that has to do with how we eat. If you're eating a bunch of white flour, white sugar, white fat, you're not getting those modulators that are going to influence in a positive way how your cells through these receptors would respond to a virus. So here's another part of a story related to how important diet complexity and composition has on the relative risk of your immune system to infection.
Well, you mentioned the flavonoid family, and why don't we explore that a little bit more deeply as it might relate to our body's ability to get rid of senescent immune cells.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very hot topic. And, you know, this really is where I got started about 3 years ago in doing a little bit of a deeper dive in this whole area. I got very interested in what is called immunophenotyping. And that's a long word that really means trying to understand how each part of the immune system works, this complex matrix, and to see if you could regulate the personality of the immune system with specific dietary factors. And that led me into getting involved with single cell immune cell counting and some new technologies that allow us to really understand how the immune cell responds to a specific variable like diet. And as I was getting into this, lo and behold, I recognized that this was an exploding area of fundamental research on the frontier of immune system development that was really driven by what was going on with precision cancer therapy. And I didn't recognize the correlation and the convergence of that until about 2 years ago when I invited to one of our meetings an investigator from Mass General Harvard who was really an expert in this whole precision cancer therapy area and the PD-1 inhibitors and how this whole relates to this revolutionary breakthrough in biological treatment of personalized cancer treatment. And what I came to recognize through that work was that these drugs give kind of a amplified ability for us to understand how the immune system regulates its response. In this case, it's to a transformed tumor cell, but it could be also a transformed virally activated cell, and that it relates to this regulation that occurs through activators and inhibitors that are part of the immune system that cause it to differentiate. Now, what does all this mean? What this means is that there are members of the phytochemical family, as you were mentioning, the flavonoid family, things like hesperidin, luteolin, fisetin, quercetin, rutin. These are flavonoids that have undergone fairly extensive research over the last few years to look at their role they play in modulating the personality of the immune system and how it activates and supports specific components of the immune system, the so-called cell-mediated and adaptive immune system components. And what we're now recognizing is that the aging of our immune system and the alteration of these cells and their ability to function is a component, as you mentioned, of an adverse outcome of aging. And people who age to get more disease are people who collect these damaged immune cells that are not capable of doing their function properly. And the damaged immune cells can be a result of two things, one of which is mutational injury to the immune cell, which could occur through the exposure to excessive inflammation or chemicals. And the other is epigenetic modification of the immune system, which undergoes changes because it has been exposed to bad experiences that tags the genes of the immune system in such a way as it produces a different genetic expression pattern. Both of those are modifiable through diet and lifestyle. And that's the important thing. It's not just this is a death sentence and that you can't get away from it. What you have to recognize is if you're accumulating these injured immune cells, and to some extent we call those zombie cells, that you can regenerate them by utilizing the power of diet and lifestyle to get rid of the bad and replace them with the new undamaged cells. And that to me is been given a name. It's called senolytics, meaning lytic means to break down or to get rid of. So you're getting rid of senescence. You're getting rid of these aged immune cells that are involved with senescence, which is aging, and replacing them then, giving the body to replace them, the opportunity to replace them with these new fresh immune cells. So this whole field of senolytics and how it ties to nutrition and how that ties to immune vigilance and resilience is an extraordinary, I think, new chapter in understanding the importance of immune system and the ability to modify its function by how we treat it.
So this aging of our immune systems and cellular aging in general really is a powerful correlate with general aging of the entire body.
Yes.
And may, I think, to circle back around, may in fact be very relevant as it relates to this correlation between aging and poor response to this infection.
That's right. And you used a term earlier, which I want to re-emphasize. When we hear aging, we most often think of the number of birthdays we had. And even if we cheat on our birthdays, we still have them. And so people say, well, that's not a modifiable factor. It's just like the luck of the draw of time. I can't do anything about it. But you use the term biological aging, which I think is a very, very important redefinition or reinterpretation of aging. Steve Horvath, who is at UCLA, is a renowned epigeneticist who has been studying biological and chronological aging using markers of our immune system cells to determine what the age of that person is. And he has developed the Horvath age determinant clock. Some people, I think he actually called it the grim age, which is kind of not a very positive thing. But by taking white blood cells and other cell types and actually measuring their architecture of their epigenome, the methylation patterns of their genes, he was able to predict very accurately what their age in years is, their chronologic age, but even more importantly, finding that their biological age of these cells, in some cases, were vastly different than the chronological age and the number of birthdays. that some people whose age and birthdays, their biological age of these cells was much older. And other people with a lot of birthdays, the biological age of their cells were much younger. So we can say that our age and birthdays is related to our biological function, but they're not one-to-one. Our biological function of our immune system can be much younger than our age and birthdays, but it can also be much older in terms of its senescence.
So just as a perspective statement, we could say that your immune system is compromised because you are old, but what you've just said is we are old biologically because our immune systems are compromised.
That's really well said. And, you know, people might who are in this field of molecular gerontology might challenge that a little bit. They say, well, hold it just a minute. I mean, the trajectory as we get older in all animals is to lose function. I mean, you can't be at 90 the exact same function you were at 20. So, let's not go overboard with this model. But what we do know for a fact, and there are many, many studies now that are demonstrating this, both in animal models and in humans, is that if you do certain things, and I'm going to talk about one which is getting a lot of attention right now, which is various forms of fasting mimicking diets, time-restricted feeding, or fasting itself, that you can reverse the biological age of your immune system. You can repattern the immune system through this process of autophagy that I mentioned earlier to get rid of these senescent zombie cells and to replace them with young, naive, more fresh, active immune cells through a process of how you eat, when you eat, and the amount you eat. And I think this is a major scientific breakthrough that goes back to the concept of calorie restriction. This goes way back to studies that were done actually in the 50s and 60s showing that calorie restriction in animals could lead to upward of a 30% increase in their longevity. But we didn't have a mechanistic understanding. Now the mechanism is starting to become much more well understood that we're actually rejuvenating these cells, particularly immune cells, through the process of getting rid of damaged cells and replacing them with younger cells.
I'd like you to tell us more about that, but I want to just let our viewers know that if you reread the blog that I posted that is going along with this interview, we talk about all these terms. What does senolytic mean? What is autophagy all about? What is the value of caloric restriction versus intermittent fasting? And we talk about what is called senomorphic therapy. And just so stay tuned, because I'm certain that Dr. Bland will talk to us about that in just a moment. But let's go in a little bit more depth in terms of things like caloric restriction, intermittent fasting. I know we've been doing pretty much a weekly fast with our Facebook group for 24 hours with this idea in mind. But talk to us about this whole concept of how hormesis, define that term, how that might be beneficial for our immune function.
Yes, I think this is one of the, to me, major scientific breakthroughs of our era. This is the kind of stuff that wins Nobel Prizes, is the recognition that certain rhythms of life really modulate functions at every organ and every tissue level. And rhythms, including the rhythms of eating, influence the clocks of our body, and the clocks of our body then regulate our metabolism and our health and function. What I said there in kind of a maybe a lengthy sentence is a huge breakthrough in understanding. So what we're starting to recognize is that the taking the load off of our bodies of eating for a period of, say, 12 hours, moves us into a different physiological state function. And that state function is such that it activates the ability of our body to cleanse these damaged cells, the process you mentioned, autophagy, while also simultaneously leading for the renewal of new fresh immune cells. And in so doing, also, because you're getting rid of these damaged cells that are generally then converted into a personality of being inflamed. This is the process of inflammaging, that you're getting rid of the burden of inflammation. So you're lowering the inflammasome activity, you're lowering the resident sterile inflammation, and you're enhancing the resilience of your cells to be able to handle the stress of living, like viral infections, more effectively. So these studies that are ongoing at laboratories around the world, you think of the work of Walter Longo at USC as one of the principals, or Satchinanda Panda at SOC. These are really tremendously interesting basic and clinical science studies, even in cancer therapy, showing that fasting physiology can improve the effectiveness of chemotherapeutic drugs and improve outcome in tumor-bearing individuals. So I think we're witnessing a true transformation to recognize that it's not just what you eat, but it's how you eat and when you eat that is also extraordinarily important in modulating our biological function and therefore our biological age and our process of aging.
And the competency of our immune systems. So what we've mentioned then, I want to spin this in a positive way, is that lifestyle choices sort of have cast the die in many people in terms of a poor response with respect to COVID-19 infection. But what you've just told us, the glass half full part of the story, is that to a significant degree, perhaps we can undo our past transgressions and repopulate with younger, more functional cells, rid ourselves to some degree of senescent, less functional immune cells by engaging something like autophagy via intermittent fasting, caloric restriction, perhaps long-term fasting, or perhaps, as Dr. Walter Longo talks about, a fasting mimicking diet. Mm-hmm. So you're telling us good things here that are really, may well be very powerful in terms of how we can set ourselves up for what may be inevitable, that is the exposure to this virus and how we respond to it. That's the big unknown for many of us.
Yes, I think you've hit the major issue perfectly in the bullseye, that this concept of immune resilience is related to the reserve that we have in our immune system above that which we need just to function every day and not to feel like we're ill. When we're exposed to something that's putting a stress on our immune system, in this case, obviously, the COVID-19 virus, it's calling forth how much reserve we have in the bank account. And that really is related to the biological function of our immune system, which then ties to the biological age of our immune system, which then is a legacy of how we've treated it prior to the exposure. So just like if you take all of your reserves out of your bank account because you are on a buying spree, and then something comes up unexpected, like say your income tax is higher and you have to pay it, you go to your bank account, you have no money in the bank account, what are you going to do? You're going to be in a heap of trouble, and the IRS is not going to be happy with you. Well, that's the same thing that we're talking about here. If you've depleted your reserve in your immune system, and now you put on it pressure that is required to mobilize that reserve that doesn't exist, now you're in a world of hurt. And what the immune system will do is it will do everything it possibly can to save you. It'll call out every guard. It'll squeeze itself to the max. And now you have the examples of the cytokine storms and the overreactions and the people whose immune system becomes their foe rather than their friend.
You know, as this was getting ramped up 6 weeks ago or so, there was a lot of commentary that for some strange reason, in the United States, younger people were ending up in the hospital. Younger people were having bad reactions. And it was puzzling to everybody because these are young and healthy individuals. And I wanted to deconstruct that because, to be fair, young doesn't necessarily mean healthy, especially with all due respect to here in the United States, where we have very high rates of type 2 diabetes, where we have things like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and certainly obesity in younger and younger people. So again, this is that big disparity between biological and chronological age that I think well explains why so-called younger people are having worse response than they did in other countries. Did I lose you?
You have stated one of the most important, I think, takeaways from this discussion between the two of us. If we look at the frequency of adverse outcomes from COVID, where do we see it? We see it disproportionately in people of socioeconomic deprivation. We see it in individuals who have poor lifestyle habits, by excessive alcohol or smoking. We see it in people who have been consuming diets that are high in empty calories. We see it in individuals that are overly stressed, not sleeping well. I mean, there are all these factors which we can identify and list that point us towards the conclusion that you've just described, that our society is basically not healthy. The absence of disease does not mean the presence of health. The absence of disease just means that you're not being treated for a disease, but your reserve, which is a measure of your health, may still be significantly compromised. And so I think what you just said is so extraordinarily important. There are studies that have been published, as you know, over the last year, looking at Gen X and looking at these next generations coming up, saying that they are the most unhealthy generations that we have seen probably ever, and that they are very worried. What will happen as they grow older? Will they just overburden the disease care system and they won't be able to work? They will be disabled because their general resident health, as you indicated, with insulin resistance and fatty liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome, and all the kind of dysfunctions that are now being seen that are chronic in nature, are the early warning signs that our resilience of these generations to come are extraordinarily compromised. And therefore, as they do grow older and their cells become more senescent, as all older organisms do, now their reserves are already in a state to prime them for all sorts of problems of these subsequent infections and pandemics. And we add on to that climate change, we add on to that crowding of cities, we add on to that transportation, all sorts of other covariables, all of which amplify the fact that we should be reframing our whole healthcare system to deal with not the presence of disease, but the absence of resilience. Resilience is going to be the future. It's not just preventing disease. It is creating resilience in our population because it can bring the whole of our economy down, as we see already, just in the last 2 months with one pandemic infection. The influence on all aspects of living, economic, political, socially, culturally, biologically, and as the reserves of our body's health as a population is compromised, our ability to manage those things will become more and more precarious, and we will then not just flood our hospitals, but we will ruin our economy and our quality of life. And we're not investing in that as a country right now. We are still of the belief that as long as you have hospitals and medicines and surgery, you can save all these people on the other end of the curve. And that has been proven incorrect with COVID-19. That model is fallacious. It does not work.
Well, I mean, the whole notion of calling what we have here a health care system, it has nothing to do with health. It's response oriented. And there's precious little care that goes on as well. So we need to call it something else. We'll have to leave that for another time. I want to thank you for spending time with us today. We have to do this again soon. I think I have the feeling we have a lot of unfinished business here.
Well, the chance to kind of meld our minds together and talk about things that we believe are very, very important and kind of see where our paths and backgrounds converge is, to me, like one of the most exciting ways that I could spend my time. So thank you.
Great to see you. Stay healthy, my friend.
You do the same. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. So I think you can see why I have such incredible respect for Dr. Jeffrey Bland. He is at the forefront in our understanding about immune function and how our immune function declines as we age, how that might relate to bad outcome with reference to COVID-19, and really further, what we can do about that right now today. Powerful information. I hope you found it helpful. That's all for now. See you soon. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter.